Welcome into What in God's Name. She's Shayna Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
Happy New Year, Shayna.
Happy New Year, Chris, and to all of our listeners.
So the first thing on the agenda, I wanted to circle back to some news that you put forward a few shows ago. You told everybody that Arlo is an intact male, and that if anyone had a dog that they wanted to breed with Arlo, that Arlo was available. And so I'm wondering if you had any responses.
Did I have any response to the puppy booty call? No, I have not. And I'm disappointed. I guess nobody saw his picture because he's adorable. He's a really good guy. Little Shih Tzu, 11-pound Imperial. Pedigree.
And has Arlo told you whether he's disappointed that there's been no response?
He has not. He's been a little busy during the holidays. So he hasn't had a whole lot of time to think about it. But
So I don't know about these things. Does a Shih Tzu need another Shih Tzu, or, you know, what's acceptable here?
No. And Shih Tzus blend really well with different dogs. I mean, there's a lot of different people have combined Shih Tzus and poodles, and they've combined, yeah, all sorts of things. They make for really cute dogs. And if you go online, you can even look this stuff up. You can even, like, Google a Shih Tzu and a Chihuahua. Although in that case, the female should be at least as big as he is, because we don't want a 3-pound Chihuahua trying to deliver 3-pound puppies. That wouldn't work well.
Okay. Well,
he's a good boy. He's just sitting over here right now, curled up on my jacket in the sunshine, being absolutely adorable.
He's storing his energy for upcoming events.
He is. 2019 could be his year.
What in God's name? We're looking at news and culture through a philosophical and theological lens, which is different from what we usually get in the news. We're not into partisan analysis. So, Shayna, I wanted to start today. We are in the midst of a government shutdown, and I have some thoughts to share with you and our listeners about this government shutdown that we're in the midst of. The angle I want to take, Shayna, is I want to think about the United States Congress in general. And the perspective I want to take on this comes from mental health counseling. I'm sure you're familiar with solution-based therapies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So for our audience, just the idea behind this particular way of doing mental health counseling is oftentimes people come, even in our own lives, we can come with stories that are problem-saturated. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough time. No one likes me. We tell ourselves stories all the time, mm-hmm. and they can become problem-saturated.
But yes, they can, and become a personal narrative.
Yeah. So we can tell problem-saturated stories about our government as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
I want to come at it with a solution-based perspective about the United States Congress, and in particular, the House of Representatives.
And none of this is political?
Well, you can tell me.
Okay.
We'll see. I think it's political philosophy. It's not political partisanship.
Okay.
Three solutions I have for the United States House of Representatives. One would be gerrymander reform. We know that various state legislatures have drawn congressional districts to favor one party or another, and it has gone both ways. Most of what we do know currently are Republican gerrymanders in states like North Carolina and Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
In the state of Maryland, the Democrats have done the same. So mm-hmm. this is the philosophical idea here is about power and how human beings crave worldly power and then end up doing a lot of nasty things to hold on to it. Second solution is term limits. The result of that would be people who are less beholden to money in politics and less fearful. People in Congress don't speak their mind because they're afraid.
Yes. Yes.
That they won't be elected. And so it would interrupt this idea of the career. You know, my career is on the line if I tell the truth or if I take a principled stand. If you have a term limit, then you're free to do that. And we see that with members of Congress who are retiring. They seem a little bit more free. Third thing I would point to for solution-based therapy for the United States House of Representatives is increasing the self-pride in Congress, for Congress as an institution, co-equal with the executive branch. Right now, what we have are people who are more, their allegiance is to their party, not to the institution of Congress. And so you have a Congress that tends to lay down in front of executive power.
And the third part that you didn't name but is in there are the lobbyists and big money. You know, and I've often said that getting money out of politics has got to be the primary struggle of our day, because with so much money in politics and so many of us with so little of it, there really can't be a true democracy. I love your lineup. I would, and I don't disagree with term limits, but if we were going to stick to a list of three, I would swap term limits with getting finances out of government. But if we can have four, then I would just add it to the list.
You know, when I think about these things, I always come back to, and I mentioned this earlier, but I just say it again, how human beings deal with power.
Oh.
The attractions of power.
Have you seen The Favorite?
No.
Okay. I want to recommend it to you. I want to recommend it to all of our listeners. Hands down, I think this movie has some of the best acting I have ever seen. And while there are other really great movies out there this year, all vying for the awards, the acting in this movie is absolutely breathtaking. And it is an incredibly unnerving and disturbing view of how power, absolute power, corrupts absolutely. I mean, that's been the subject of conversation for as long as human beings have kept records. Of the oldest writings in the world all contain stories that basically can be reduced to absolute power corrupts absolutely. And if you're in it long enough, you know, it'll mess you up. But that's my good news for 2019.
You know, thank you for your...
Hopefully.
Wait a minute.
I hate to be the angel of darkness here. But
I was supposed to be the angel of darkness here.
Right.
But thank you for taking that role, because it keeps me on my toes. So I'll be the more hopeful voice sometimes. Shana, let's move on.
Okay.
We've got another segment to get to in our show today, Answering Albert. Shana, last month in December, December 10th, was the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was ratified on December 10th, 1948. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, is it mere words? And we're going to cover that in a second. The way we're going to cover this question is by introducing our Answering Albert segment. Because this is our first Answering Albert segment that we're going to have on our show, I wanted to help our listeners understand the idea behind it. Why do we have this segment? First of all, Albert Mohler is the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He makes assertions and assumptions that need to be challenged. That's the first reason that we are answering Albert, because he needs an answer. But we wouldn't answer him except for the fact that he is influential. He has a wide audience.
Yep.
We also wouldn't answer him except for the fact that he is a Christian brother. He's influential, and he makes claims about Christianity that I need to take issue with as a Christian.
Oh, well, I need to take issue with him, too. I mean, I very often hear him say things about we Christians. I think to myself, whoa, who we, white man? This is not my brand.
Yeah. And then finally, I want to say we want to take the time to answer Albert, because we also want to affirm the places where we do agree.
Well, and let me add one more thing to that, Chris, which is that I think in this day and age, it is not a terrible thing to model thoughtful and respectful disagreement.
Yes, I think that's right.
And so that's what we'll be reaching for. You, our beloved audience, are invited to let us know if you detect something less than that, but that is the aspiration.
That's the aim. That's what we aspire to. I also thought, well, if I am a listener and I am not a Christian, why should I care about what Albert says, and why should I care about what we would answer Albert with? My thought about this is that the religious voices in America are part of this great American mosaic. So if we think of the voices in the public square, the religious voice is one of those voices. And so I think it's incumbent on us. Let me just finish this thought. It's incumbent on us to make that voice as good and as true and as faithful as it can be. That's respectful.
Right. And let's be clear that Al Mohler also represents a segment of the Christian tradition which gets all of the limelight, all of the airtime. You know, when you talk to people about Christians in America, many people, particularly liberal people, immediately think about the Southern Baptists. They think about evangelical Christians. They think about white Republican gun-toting, pickup truck driving, Koran burning. And that's their image of Christianity, largely because that's what's portrayed in the media, which is in part why you and I are here doing what we're doing, is to say, hey, we're Christians, and look, we don't sound anything like those guys. So let's just be clear that for folks who are not Christian, that Christianity has never been of one mind. It's why we have four Gospels. Even the folks who lived in or near or around Jesus's time couldn't agree on the story. So there are four different Gospels. There have always been different sects of Christianity. So when somebody tells you that they are a Christian, you have to, that doesn't, you really kind of need to ask more questions. You know, what kind of Christian are you? And if they say to you, well, what do you mean, what kind of Christian am I? There's only one kind of Christian, then you know exactly who you're talking to.
Well said, Shana. Thank you. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, is it mere words? We're going to play some segments from Albert Mohler's reflections on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. As we play this clip from Albert Mohler's podcast, listen to two foghorns. Shana, listen for the two foghorn blasts towards the end. I added those. Those are not Albert Mohler's foghorn blasts.
Right. Those are our signals that something has just been said that we take issue with. Warning.
Warning.
It's a warning.
Look out.
Yep, look out.
So listen.
Sharp
for the
rocks ahead.
Listen for the foghorn.
But next we turn to the international scene, a story with vast worldview implications. Yesterday was the anniversary, the 70th anniversary, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It was adopted on December 10, 1948. As NPR reported yesterday, given the rivalries and violence that divide the global community today, it is hard to imagine that on December 10, 1948, the nations of the world approved almost unanimously a detailed list of fundamental rights that every human being on the planet should enjoy. The document adopted 70 years ago yesterday is entitled the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. As NPR reported, it is the most sweeping such document ever endorsed on a worldwide basis. The document opens with the words, "All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights." Why would this statement have been adopted so overwhelmingly 70 years ago yesterday? The answer has everything to do with the ruins of the world after World War II. There was an understanding that somehow, in some way, with some words, the nations of the world must come together after World War II and affirm a basic statement of human rights and human dignity. It was a well-intended document, we might say, one of the earliest and most important actions of the group that is now known as the United Nations. As you look at the history and you go back, you recognize that at the end of World War II, after the world was largely morally and, of course, in military terms, spent at the conclusion of that horrifying war, the question was, how in the world can we avoid this kind of horrifying event, these kinds of atrocities in the future? The best answer, this is very telling too, the best answer that the world could come up with in 1948 was a statement. We go back to that opening of the document, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Now just consider for a moment one very important aspect of this statement. It is not so much that the statement is wrong. It is the fact that what you see here is a secular effort to try to affirm human rights and human dignity, even assuming what it means to be human in a statement that has no basis whatsoever for moral authority beyond the authority of the nations that comprise the United Nations and the moral authority of the United Nations itself. What we see here is the great liberal myth that somehow human dignity and human rights can be grounded merely in a human statement of affirmation. But from a Christian worldview perspective, the saddest part of this is the realization that without a biblical grounding of human rights and human dignity, without an understanding of human beings as made in God's image, the fact is everything becomes endlessly and inevitably negotiable.
You know what, Chris? This one I have to call Al out on respectfully, but this is the kind of stuff that sows deep seeds of divisiveness, because he is claiming solo moral authority to biblical scripture. Well, how about those people who don't read Bible? How about those people who read the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita? You know, are we saying that those people are incapable of any sort of morality or ethic? Because what he's sowing right there is the stuff that gives certain Christians the notion that we have to conquer these people, we have to convert them all to our way of thinking, because apart from our way of thinking, there is no morality or ethics. I mean, that's the natural conclusion from what he's preaching there. I don't know if that's what he intended, but that's what I hear, and I frankly think it's dangerous.
My take on it is similar but somewhat different in this regard. And again, with all due respect to Albert, what I point to is missteps in the reasoning. I'm not sure what the art is, so I take it as an argument. Like, what argument is Albert making here? And there's really no argument. It's simply an assertion that if there's no biblical backup, then everything is up for grabs. So if it's just an assertion, I mean, one response is to assert back, no, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. But we should do better. I should be able to articulate some kind of argument that refutes that. And the argument would simply be this. The argument is simply this, that there are different ways to account for the goodness of the good.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the Bible is rich. I mean, I love the scripture. I love my life lived against it, and my life wasn't always lived against that backdrop. So, you know, I'm a person who came to scripture as an adult. Therefore, I have memory of a life before scripture. And I have, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love my life way more against the backdrop of scripture, but to claim, I don't know, man, it's just the idea that anybody would claim to know the will and the mind of God. It makes me want to sit very, very far away from that person.
Yeah.
So when the lightning bolt comes in, I'm nowhere near it.
The fascinating conversation with Albert Mohler would be questions of epistemology, then how do you know?
How do you know what you know?
I think it would be then an account of, well, it's in the Bible, but then it's to your point.
There are lots of things in the Bible.
What is then your process of reading? How do you understand human reading of texts?
It's something that I've had to deal with on a number of occasions, is particularly around the LGBTQ argument, is fundamentalist Christians who will come at me with the book of Leviticus, which is laughable because as someone who grew up in the Jewish tradition, you know, it's like I didn't know much about scripture, but I knew Leviticus. So, you know, if you want to rumble, we can rumble in Leviticus. But the bottom line is that Leviticus is not a solo book. It's part of a larger body of work that cannot be broken down and separated. So you cannot say, for example, well, it says in Leviticus that two men laying together is an abomination. Okay, if you accept that, then you have ascribed to a body of law that also says you need to be circumcised, you can't wear mixed fiber shirts, your kitchen better be kosher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is not a book you can cherry pick from. It is not a body of work. It is a construct of laws and practices designed to help people live more closely in concert with their God, to avail themselves and open themselves up to the wisdom and the love of God. So, but these folks will claim to have, you know, deep knowledge of that. Well, because it says right here in Leviticus. And when you say to them, no, you can't separate that out, you know, get out of my scripture and get into yours. Okay, let's go to the second half of the book, right? And then, you know, we'll take it from there.
That's what I mean when I said unserious. It's literalistic, that way of reading Leviticus, cherry picking the
passage.
I think
the word
I think that's unserious.
I think the word you're. Well, let me ask you.
Because no. You can
this
assert
is about
it. Go ahead.
To sound.
Tell
this,
me. Tell me what I mean to say.
God, talk about arrogant, but it's uneducated. It's uneducated.
Okay,
I mean,
right,
I'm just going to name it how I see it. I just don't think it's not a scholarly. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. It's really not a scholarly approach to Scripture.
To read that way, yeah, beautiful.
And we've been raised in a free tradition that wants their clergy educated and lettered. We take that body of knowledge out into our congregations and try to teach it to our people that they may be raised up and educated and critical thinkers and practitioners of interpreting and engaging with the word, which is a live, dynamic, constantly unfolding thing.
And when you say educated, I think not in the sense of credentialed, academic, snooty, but in the Platonic sense of educated.
Well, in this day and age, that pretty much educated equates with.
I know.
That whole list
exactly,
of stuff you just said.
That whole anti-elitist kind of idea. But educated from perspective of Plato is closer to the truth. An educated perspective is a perspective that is closer to
the truth.
Yes,
see,
not
there's humility.
In possession of.
There, yes.
Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Is it mere words? Albert Mohler wants to.
Funny from a guy who's scripturally based.
Right. And so, yes, exactly. What else do we have but words?
In the beginning was the Word.
What else do we have?
And the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and everything that came into being through the Word.
Yeah. So Albert seems to be searching for some kind of backstop, like words aren't enough. It's got to be a broader picture, a broader conversation, and a broader way of understanding where goodness comes from and what its authority is. You can be good and not be religious. You can believe that goodness has an independent existence.
Yeah, and you can also be a person who absolutely hitches your wagon to what Al is saying, which is my ethics and my morality is absolutely tied to my understanding of God and how the Scripture reveals God to me on a daily basis as I read And that's fine, so long as you can also make room for the fact that while your neighbor may be reading different scripture or no scripture at all, they will show up as moral and ethical as you. And you need a lens, you need a decoder ring to understand and be able to see that so that you can nurture that goodness, that ethics, that morality in others, even when it doesn't show up wearing, you know, the same colors yours does.
Without Albert Mohler here to engage us in conversation, what generous interpretations can we give to his desire to ground morality in biblical authority?
Funny you should ask that, because I was thinking that very same thing as I listened to the entire segment, and I can only take my hat off to him for trying to define what is ethical and moral. But since everything else in his segment is a total put down, it was hard for me to wrap myself around much else. And so I found myself in a place of probably more disagreement with him on this segment than I have in others. There are other segments where I've listened and said, yeah, no, I can agree with that, that last part. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. That's well said. And my generous reading of Albert is that throughout this segment, he is saying human dignity and these human rights that are enumerated in this Universal Declaration, these are important and good and valuable.
Touche. Good for you for finding that good streak throughout the segment, Chris. My hat's off to you. He's Chris Owen.
And she's Shana Appel. Our website, whatingods.com. That's WHATINGODS.
No apostrophe.
No apostrophe. Arlo is asleep. We are ready to sign off. Shana, great to be with you today.
And you as well, Chris.
We'll see you next time.
God bless.